Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 154 of CJ Evolution, that's Criminal Justice Evolution. Pat Fitzgibbons here, host and creator of the show, whatever you were doing, wherever you were at. Thank you for tuning in. Big shout out to the veterans out there, brave men and women who protect our country day in, day out. Hope you had a great Veterans Day. And thank you to all the first responders out there who protect the various municipalities, cities, counties, whatever you're doing out there. Thank you for doing a very difficult job in a very difficult environment. You know, as a parent, as many of you are, we all worry about our kids, whether, you know, they're doing well in school, they hope they get a good job when they get older, and most importantly, we worry about their safety. Sooner or later, folks, all of our kids are going to head off to college, or at least most of them, and that's where my next guest comes into play. He's an expert in safety and security on college campuses. He travels all around talking about the issues on college campuses, and he's a big advocate for some good reform that needs to happen on college campuses. So I give you episode 154, very informative. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my next guest on. His name is Mike Ayalon, and he is the CEO of Greek University, and he's going to talk to everybody about safety and security on college campuses. Welcome, Mike. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
Now, you're the CEO of Greek University. Now, I gave a little bit about that in the intro. Can you tell us more about what you do?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm basically the CEO of Greek University. It's an educational platform that has inspired universities all across North America in terms of resolving some current social issues. So essentially, I'm a motivational speaker. I'm also an entrepreneur. I'm an author, and I've headlined over 350 presentations across 125 college campuses to talk about issues that are facing college students, such as sexual assault prevention, hazing prevention, campus safety, alcohol and drug abuse prevention, and even topics like diversity, for example, in student organizations.
Mm-hmm. So you go all around the country. I mean, is it just you, or is other people involved, Mike?
I do have other people that are involved with the organization. I'm the primary. I'm the lead that goes out quite often. But obviously, I'm only one person. So oftentimes, I can't be in two places at the same time. And I have a crew of people that work with me that can actually travel across the country as well in case that I'm not available.
Mm-hmm. Now you gave a little, you gave some topics. What do you think the most important? I mean, there's probably just a myriad of issues out there. You named some of them, but what's the biggest issue on college campuses right now, as far as you can tell?
Well, right now, hazing and alcohol abuse seems to be the number one issue. If you look just recently over the last semester, it all started with Penn State University in August, where the president of the university said that if Greek Life has one more incident, then all of Greek Life is going to be shut down. Mm-hmm. That was after a new member died in one of the fraternity houses. Then we start moving forward towards LSU in September. There we also had a new member death, and that fraternity was shut down. There was the arrest of 10 fraternity brothers within that particular house. Then we start moving to Florida State University in November. There we had a pledge death as well, and the president of the university has an indefinite suspension on all of Greek Life until they can figure this out and the students propose some kind of solution to these issues. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, just this week, University of Michigan, the IFC, which is the umbrella organization over all fraternities, they actually shut down all of their own social events because they're recognizing that there are hazing problems in their own community. So the IFC, the students, actually voted to shut down all the social events until they can figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. And also this week, a large fraternity called Sig Ep, or Sigma Phi Epsilon, they actually declared a ban on alcohol across all of their chapters all over North America. So they're basically looking to take the alcohol out of the fraternity houses in order to prevent some of these issues. So this really seems to be some of the biggest issues we're facing right now.
But and I agree, alcohol is probably a problem, and, mm-hmm. and it is, you know, according to you, on colleges, campuses, especially in, you know, in fraternities and probably sororities too. So, but is it really realistic, Mike, to take alcohol? I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but is it realistic to think that these fraternities are just going to get rid of alcohol?
Well, in order to truly fix this thing, I think we have to have multiple ideas to try and deal with it. So the first thing is number one, you have to investigate and prosecute the students that are found guilty of crimes like hazing. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing that both administrators and also law enforcement can do, because that's the biggest motivator that other students say, you know what, this is clearly not being tolerated and I don't want a misdemeanor or a felony on my record. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is investigate and prosecute. The second is that I think we do have to shorten the pledge process. Typically, most fraternities and sororities have an 8-week new member process, and some organizations have actually completely done away with the pledge process completely. So I would suggest shortening it up. I do believe that 8 weeks is probably too long. I really don't think there's anything in the new member manual of any fraternity or sorority that I wouldn't be able to digest and understand within, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I think you can shorten that pledge process, and that certainly reduces the number of incidents that potentially could happen to a new member. The third piece is educational programs, because you have to remember, we're getting new students into our organizations every 6 months. So you really have to repeat over and over again these same educational programs to the students on a regular basis, because mm-hmm. if you haven't spoken to them in the last 6 months, then in essence, you've never spoken to them, because there are so many new members coming in every 6 months. And then finally, I do think that we need to start looking into removing alcohol from the fraternity houses. Now, there have been other organizations that have tried to do this, and it's met with some success. I won't say 100% success, but it has been met with some success. So ultimately, what we're trying to do is reduce risk. And if you're asking me, is it absolutely going to be foolproof? I don't think so.
Well, nothing is.
Right. And so I think this is a really good first step, mm-hmm. is to remove the alcohol from the fraternity houses. And listen, I understand that these are social organizations, but I think there are ways that we can essentially teach the right way to have a social event. For example, using a third-party vendor as opposed to having it in the fraternity house. Mm-hmm. And that helps to remove a lot of the liability, because now you have professional bartenders, you have people who are checking IDs at the door, and you have insurance in place at the third party venue, et cetera, et cetera. And so you really remove a lot of the liability, and you also remove a lot of the wear and tear on these fraternity houses, because obviously if you have a lot of people at your house and this goes on for a semester, a year, et cetera, there's going to be wear and tear on the house itself. Mm-hmm. So I really think that it's just a matter of educating the students in terms of the right way to do it.
Now, are majority of problems, Mike, in fraternities as opposed to sororities? I imagine sororities have their own issues, right? But not probably as much as fraternities, I imagine.
Yeah, interestingly enough, really there are a lot of rules and regulations within the world of sororities, and really they do not have any kind of alcohol or social events in their houses. Mm-hmm. So because of that rule and regulation, all of the parties and social events, et cetera, are typically held in the fraternity house.
That's interesting.
And that's the reason why the liability insurance is so much greater for the men's organizations than the women's organizations, because if there is going to be a problem, typically it happens in the fraternity.
Sure. And men are more aggressive and, you know, things like that, and tend to get in a little bit more trouble than women. So I understand.
Well, I mean, it's really the way that the system has been set up.
Mm-hmm.
So if
sure.
all social events happen in a fraternity house, yeah. then what are the odds that you're going to have an injury in a fraternity house as opposed to a sorority house? The odds are very, very high. So it's just the way the system is set up. I don't necessarily want to blame the men. It's just the way the system is set up, mm-hmm. And the rules and regulations, et cetera. But again, I do think there is a better way. I think we should be teaching really third-party venue to help eliminate some of that risk and make sure that we have professionals that are behind the bar to look out for students that might be in danger, and to have people who are checking IDs, making sure nobody under 21 is getting access to alcohol, et cetera.
Now, how many fraternities are there? Because I don't know. How many fraternities are there in the country, Mike? Do you know?
Well, okay. Yes. So basically, the NIC is the organization, the umbrella organization that sits above all of the men's social fraternities. So when you look at those, you're looking at roughly 75 organizations there.
Okay. All right. So let's shift gears a little bit. You've seen a lot of issues on college campuses, and I was glad to bring you on again because my daughter, my stepdaughter's, and she just got into a sorority. My other stepdaughter graduated college; she was in a sorority. So I thought it was interesting that you're out there doing this very valuable work. Mm-hmm. How do we prevent sexual assaults on college campuses? Because it seems like we hear a lot of. You know, and I'm in Colorado. I'm in Boulder. We got CU, University of Colorado, mm-hmm. right next to me.
Sure.
So I'm sure things like this, unfortunately, happen all the time. But what do we do? It probably starts with education, right? I mean, what are some other issues?
It starts with education. So really, we need to be talking about bystander intervention and consent and also definitions. So we'll start with the definitions piece because we throw around a lot of words like sexual assault, like rape. Many people on the college campus, they might not know the difference between those terms. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that we define that for these students. And so when we talk about sexual assault, it's defined as any type of unwanted sexual encounter by anyone at any age. And I think some of these numbers are really kind of startling when you look at it, because 21% of females are affected by sexual assault since entering college. Over a lifetime, that grows to 34% for females. Wow. And for males, it's 7% are affected since entering college and 11% over a lifetime. So it's clearly it's affected people of all races, religions, sexual orientation, and in all communities in the country by both men and women. So I think we have to dispel a lot of these myths. And make people understand that, yes, it does affect men. And so it's important for people to understand that. The other thing is that there's another myth out there that a sexual assault is committed by a stranger and that it's about sex. The reality is that it's somebody you already know over 51% of the time. The myth is that it's somebody hiding behind the bush and just scares you out of nowhere, but that's typically not the case. Strangers is only 14% of the time. Also, it's important for students to understand that it's a crime to express power and control over somebody. Sex is not the motivation behind it. So many times we see offenders that are using their position of power over somebody to reach their victims. Yep. So that could be bosses, that could be coaches, that could be teachers.
Yep.
So it's important, you know, initially we'll start with the definitions. We'll go over things like consent, which is a clear and freely given agreement for sexual contact. And then we'll talk about bystander intervention, which is the skills that the students need in order to take action and to intervene. Mm-hmm. And we'll also even talk about how to respond to a disclosure, because many times people won't really disclose to anybody. So if they do disclose, then it's important the students understand what to do. And so I think in that particular scenario, you want to make sure that you remain calm, you listen to the survivor, never blame the survivor, and reassure them that you believe them. Because many times the survivor doesn't come forward because they just think nobody's going to believe what they're saying. Mm-hmm. You have to be supportive. You have to encourage a medical legal exam at a local hospital and also report it to local law enforcement.
Yep.
That way they can get connected to sexual assault resources in their area. And I do believe there is hope and healing is possible for these survivors.
Yeah.
I also think there's also a whole host of campaigns that students have done around the campus successfully in order to bring awareness to these issues like consent and bystander intervention.
And there's so many from a law enforcement perspective. Mm-hmm. There's so many assaults that happen out there that don't get reported, like you said, because people are they're afraid, maybe they're intimidated. So mm-hmm. that's a huge issue. Just and you know, I don't know how you cure that, but other than just like saying what you're saying, Mike, there's a lot of support out there. People are going to believe you. It's okay if you come forward. But I've seen a lot of it in my time in law enforcement where people are just, you know, victims, mostly women, unfortunately, are just they're afraid to come forward because they're afraid to get ridiculed or, you know, bullied or whatever, like, you know, a myriad of things. But it's interesting you said, you know, about, you know, I know that, you know, that a lot of assaults, and it doesn't have to be just on college campuses, a lot of assaults are perpetrated by people who the victim knows. So that's very, very important that you said that because, very, very, I mean, I've been in law enforcement 21 years and I can count on one hand how many stranger assaults I've seen. Just mm-hmm. I mean, the majority of the time, you're exactly right. You know, the victim knows the perpetrator.
Yep.
You talked a little bit at the beginning about hazing. Mm-hmm. How do we prevent that too, Mike? I mean, because I think it's one of those things, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. It's always gone on, but I think we just live in such an interconnected society now where we hear more of it, right? I mean, we have technology at our fingertips. It's reported more. So how do we prevent it?
You know, it is a widespread problem. The reality is 55% of college students have been hazed, and 47% were hazed before they even came to college. So that could be in athletics, that could be in the band. I've even seen it on church retreats when they're in high school. So, and they end up bringing some of these techniques that they've used in high school to college. And the other issue is that 9 out of 10 people who experience hazing didn't even consider themselves hazed. And just like you mentioned, 95% of people did not report it. So it becomes very difficult to get a handle on this issue when there's such little in terms of actual reporting and even understanding that what they went through is actually considered hazing. Now, it's important for students to understand it's not about earning your way into an organization. It's all about control, authority, domination, and bullying. And interestingly enough, it's usually practiced by members in the organization who lack courage. They lack self-confidence, and they have very low self-esteem. They're just trying to justify their place in the organization. Now, understand this has been going on for a long time. We've seen it in the military, certainly. We've seen it in athletics. We've seen it all over the place. Hazing was actually found at Harvard as early as 1657. There was actually a law on the books in Harvard that said that freshmen are supposed to run errands for all upperclassmen. They should never be saucy, and they should obey every upperclassman's order. So this has been going on for a long time. Yeah. It's nothing that, you know, it's just popped up over the last decade or anything like that. And there's been a lot of people who have done some research in terms of trying to understand why hazing happens. There's a guy by the name of Aldo Simino, and he wrote an article in 2011 showing 4 sociological factors that contribute to hazing. The first one is dominance or bullying. The next one is solidarity or unity. The next one is commitment to the organization. They don't want to just freely give access to the organization without having to work for it. And then the next is preventing exploitation of group benefits. So, for example, there are a lot of benefits that go along with fraternity and sororities. You have social events, you have brotherhood and sisterhood events, etc. The members themselves want to prevent new members coming in and exploiting those benefits without earning it. And as the group benefits increase, the pro-hazing attitudes also increase. Also this guy out there by the name of Dr. Gentry McCreary, he wrote a whole dissertation on what's called Bandura's theory, and really they call it moral disengagement is really what it's all about. So, you know, how do we solve it, right, is the question. I think that the students themselves have to go through 5 stages of bystander intervention. So the first thing is they have to notice the event. And again, sometimes the students, they don't even notice that it's going on. The next is they have to believe it's a problem. Next, they have to feel some responsibility. The fourth is they have to know what to do. And the fifth is they have to have the ability to act. So for students that are going through a new member process, I think it's important for them to define what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. They should not be accepting tradition as the reason why we're doing this particular activity. I want them to use their minds. I want them to use their heads and say, why are we doing this? What is the purpose? What is the risk? What are the goals? Ask those questions, and if you don't get good answers and all you're getting back is, well, it's tradition, then that's not acceptable. They have to use their heads. They're very smart. They need to think about why they're doing it. And I think they need to voice their opinions. I think they can choose not to participate. They can talk to other members about their concerns. So I think there's a whole bunch of things that they can do to come up with new activities that actually promote chapter bonding as opposed to pledge class bonding, which is typically what they're trying to do.
And I bet you, Michael, I'm speaking to the choir. I mean, I bet you that's all you hear a lot is, well, this is how this fraternity always did it. So like you said, it's tradition. So we really don't have a good excuse. And that, because they were taught that and they were taught that before. And so it's just a matter of breaking that cycle, right? That mentality.
Yeah, once you break the cycle, then all suddenly it's like, well, we've been doing it the right way forever. You know, they don't even realize that there was a problem. So you just have to break the cycle. And once you break it, and you put in some really good new events that promote chapter unity or organizational unity and with nothing being considered hazing, suddenly they're doing everything right. And then you check in with them a year or two later and it's gone.
Yeah.
But you have to make sure that you plug in something to replace the hazing event. You can't just take out the hazing event and expect that it's going to go away, because what happens is another hazing event comes in its place. But it's like a vacuum. So you have to plug in something new that enables them to promote chapter immunity without it being considered hazing.
What about alcohol and drug abuse? I know we talked a little bit about some alcohol getting taken away from, I can't remember what fraternity you were talking about earlier. You know, it's such a huge issue. I mean, in Colorado, you know, and you know, we're, you know, 420, we got marijuana everywhere. I mean, how do we prevent, you know, in a lot of states or in every state, how do we prevent that abuse that's going on? Because it seems it's just permeated the you know, the college life. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe I'm just, that's an overstatement, but it seems like it's everywhere.
You're right about that. And you know what? The legalization of marijuana, it complicates this even further, because now I'm talking to students about alcohol and drug abuse. And in some cases, they're saying, Mike, you're talking to me about not using marijuana, but it's legal in my state. So there's a conflict there. And it makes my job much more difficult. You know, one of the interesting things that I live just outside of Nashville, and one of the things that we're dealing with here in this area of the country is opioids, which I know you're very familiar with.
Everywhere, Mike. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. And it's, you know, what is an opioid? It's a painkiller that reduces feeling in the body. You produce it naturally in your brain. It's called morphine. So if you, by accident, are doing some work around the house and you use a hammer and you hit your finger, you know, immediately your brain is actually going to be producing morphine in order to make that pain sensation slowly go away. So that's naturally in your body. Your doctor can also prescribe it in the form of oxycodone, for example, and people who go through surgeries and things like that, they might need that prescribed by a doctor. But then there's also the street varieties, and that would include heroin and meth. Now, the problem that we're seeing with opioids, and I think this is the biggest crisis of all, is we have 142 Americans that are dying every single day from opioid addiction. And one of the reasons why is because it's so accessible.
Yeah,
I mean, even if you think about any other drug, even marijuana, it's so much easier to get your hands on one of these opioids because it's in medicine cabinets all across the country. It's just so accessible. And here's the other problem. I speak to law enforcement on a regular basis, and fentanyl is something that is a synthetic drug made in China, and it's typically used for late-stage cancer, and it's 30 to 50 times more powerful than heroin. And what's happening is that it's actually cheaper than the heroin itself.
Oh, yeah.
So what's happening is that dealers are actually mixing in fentanyl along with either heroin or in some cases even marijuana. The law enforcement here in Tennessee have confiscated marijuana that has traces of fentanyl in it. And people, the issue is that users don't even know what's in the heroin, or in this case, marijuana, and then they overshoot the mark. So now suddenly you have an overdose because they thought that they were getting pure heroin, they thought that they were getting pure marijuana, and it's not.
Yep.
And so suddenly now we have overdoses. And so these overdoses are happening at such a high rate. I mean, think about it. 142 Americans die every single day. This is an epidemic. That's why the president has declared this as an emergency, because it's a major issue. And now law enforcement is now using Narcan to combat opioid overdoses. So the police in my town here in Tennessee, they all have this Narcan in their vehicle. So that way they can actually spray that into the nose of somebody who is dealing with an opioid overdose to instantly bring them back. And it basically blocks the brain's receptors to this drug, and you can bring them back right away. So they're all equipped with this. And this is a major, major issue. And I just want to bring it up because obviously it's something that's in the news and everybody's dealing with it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a huge issue, and college campuses obviously are affected by it. And yeah, I mean, my department carries Narcan too. Narcan is not, for people listening who don't know, you know, Narcan is not the cure for an opiate addiction. It's just designed to get you to that next level of care. Like Mike said, I mean, it's, we have the intranasal stuff that we can shoot in your nose, but it's just designed to get you to that next level of care. It's not a, you know, it doesn't help you get over, you know, an opiate addiction. But so how do you, when you go and talk, you know, to campuses, Mike, and you start talking about the opiate crisis, and you start talking about, you know, the alcohol abuse that seems to be running rampant on college campuses. I mean, how do you get kids or young adults, how do you get them to kind of say, you know, to wake up and say, yeah, you're right. I mean, how do you prevent some of this stuff? I mean, you're not going to prevent all of it, but I mean, you know, how do you get through to them?
A lot of it's education. They need to understand what they're putting in their body. So let's take alcohol, because obviously alcohol is something that is prevalent. It's all over the place, all over the world. When we start talking about alcohol, I specifically start talking about binge drinkers. And we define binge drinkers as people who drink five or more drinks in a row. So if you are a binge drinker, then the students themselves need to understand what is the risk to them. Okay, and so we start there. Binge drinkers have significantly higher risks for lots of risky behaviors, including other substance abuse, like overdoses, like we were talking about, violence. So we see that people who are binge drinkers are much more prone to violence, depression and self-harm. So we've now seen over the last few years, suicides have peaked higher than I've ever seen before. There's really something going on in terms of mental health and suicide, and it's connected to binge drinking. Also, binge drinkers are much higher activity of high risk sexual activity. So they're at much greater risk if you're a binge drinker of contracting a sexually transmitted disease or HIV. And we're also seeing motor vehicle related problems. So people who are binge drinkers have low seatbelt use. They tend to be okay with riding with somebody who's already drinking, and they're also themselves now at risk for DUI or DWI. And students need to understand that it also causes a loss of memory, coordination, judgment, and some cancer and liver problems. So I think the key is to explain what happens when you use these things, because I don't think that they necessarily consider all of that. And if you're talking about even marijuana use, right? And again, in some states like Colorado, where you're at, people will say, well, you know, it's everywhere. Well, guess what? Students who are not current marijuana users are more than twice as likely to report an average grade of an A than those who do use it. So if you are not a current marijuana user, you have a 30% chance of getting an A in school. Okay. If you are a current marijuana user, you have a 12.5% chance of getting an A. And the reason why? Poor class attendance for those who are using marijuana on a regular basis. And marijuana also affects brain development. So all of the reduced thinking, the reduced memory, and reduced learning function that you think is just a short-term effect, it may actually last a very long time or even be permanent. And we're also seeing breathing problems with people who use marijuana, similar to tobacco usage, also increased heart rates. So it may increase your chances of a heart attack. So I think the key, you know, the answer to your question is that we need to educate the students about what the risks are and what they're doing to their body and how that's going to affect, let's say, academics, for example. Because ultimately, as a CEO, the only way that I know how to differentiate between two students at a college in terms of which one is going to get a job is based on their GPA, right? I mean, yeah, there's other things. There's, you know, other organizations that they're involved in, et cetera. But ultimately, it comes down to GPA. And we now have scientific evidence that shows us that if you are a daily marijuana smoker, your grades are going to suffer because you just have poor class attendance. It's just a fact. And so, you know, these are the types of conversations that we have. And I think ultimately all the students, they want to be successful, right? They don't want to have a misdemeanor or a felony on their record. And I explain to them that they're in college to get a higher paying job. They're going to get in the way of their end goal. And so I want them to focus on what the goal is. And 85% of college freshmen say the goal is to get a higher paying job. So if that's true, then having a misdemeanor or a felony on your record or poor class attendance and low academics, all of these things are not going to help you where you want to go in life.
Yes, such good information. Are you making an impact out there, Mike? I mean, you travel all around, you go to a lot of campuses. I mean, do you think there's an impact out there? Can you see it?
I can see it. It's really, really exciting. And that's really the best part of my job. You know, when I went out to a particular university in Massachusetts, I had a young lady come up to me after the presentation. And she said, Mike, she said, I just want to tell you, this presentation was amazing. She said, you are the first person that has ever come to this university to talk about sexual assault prevention. She said, I myself am the victim of sexual assault on this campus. And she said, I just want to say thank you because you're the first person that came to talk about it. And you're a fraternity man. So that tells me everything that I need to know about what a real fraternity man does. And so to me, that just blew me away. And I was like, you know what? I have to continue doing this because there are so many other students just like that. And I think in terms of actually seeing results, I see all kinds of different events that the students themselves put on, like for sexual assault prevention, for example, various campaigns that they do, whether it be men walking a mile in high heels to raise awareness about sexual abuse against women, or even tip sheets being handed out on campus on consent or bystander intervention techniques. They come up with these various campaigns after I leave, and then they share with me photos and stories in the newspaper about all of these different events that they put on following my presentation once they're armed with all this information. So absolutely, we're seeing, you know, really, really nice things happening. Sexual assaults, obviously, you know, this has been in the news with various people in the media and entertainment that are now being accused of various forms of sexual assault or sexual harassment. And I think what's happening, you're actually seeing it in real time. Men and women are feeling much more comfortable coming forward.
They are. I think you're right.
With all of these charges. And so now I think we're really at this really interesting point where now we can actually start to deal with this issue, and it's no longer being tolerated in any industry, whether it be media or entertainment or business or whatever. Now we're actually starting to see that it's no longer being tolerated, and people are coming forward, and people are being held accountable. Because now look at, you know, if we talk about Kevin Spacey, for example, all of his projects are now being canceled.
Oh, yeah.
He had a movie that was scheduled to come out within the next 6 weeks. They've actually decided that they're going to reshoot the entire movie without him in it.
Yeah.
Whatever scenes he was in.
I saw that. I saw House of Cards, if you're familiar, on Netflix.
Sure.
They canceled all that. And now, I can't remember, I was reading an article this morning. I want to say it was Baltimore, where they did a lot of the filming for that particular show. And just to your point, I mean, people are more comfortable coming forward, Mike, and just this, you know, what he did impacted so many people. And, and now that they're, you know, canceling House of Cards, I mean, people are going to lose their job, which is, you know, okay, that's the victims are more important than that. But it's just like you said, I mean, the impact of these people coming forward, you know, is very powerful. And I think it's needed. I mean, people need to feel comfortable, like you said, coming forward and getting this. They've been living with this for years.
Right. And so, I mean, the Me Too campaign, I don't know if you're familiar with that on social media, that recently took off over the last couple of weeks. So I think we're at a really important point right now. I think we're actually really starting to see measurable results. People are coming forward, and now we're seeing the accountability factor that is no longer being tolerated by anybody in any industry. And if you are going to do this stuff, nobody's going to work with you.
Yeah.
And so I do believe that we're seeing some amazing results. Now, are there still challenges within fraternity and sorority life? Absolutely. But you know what? When fraternity and sorority life is done right, I truly believe that there is no better leadership organization on any college campus. Mm-hmm. Now, there is the 1% that's doing it wrong. And so if you're doing it wrong, you could have disastrous results. Mm-hmm. And so, for me, I have children as well. I have a 12-year-old son. I have a 10-year-old daughter. I know they're going to be Greek. I mean, they already know the creed of Sigma Pi backwards and forwards. And they're 10 and 12, right? They've been around Greek life their entire life. All of my friends are Greek. So therefore, I know they're going to be in a Greek organization. And the way I look at it is I have 6 years to fix it before they get there. And ultimately, I want to keep all of our children safe, yours, mine, and everybody's.
That's awesome. Mike, we really appreciate you for doing it. It's a much needed service that you're doing out there. And, you know, with people, more people like you need to be out there spreading the word around with this important information. If people want to reach out to you, Mike, how do they find you?
Yeah, the best place to find me is on GreekUniversity.org. I'm also available on Facebook and Twitter, all at Greek University. So those are great places to reach me. My phone number and other contact information is all out there. And I look forward to working with anybody who needs the help, whether it be higher educational institutions, businesses, or really anybody. I travel all over North America, and I'd be glad to help.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, Mike. Very good information. Keep doing the good work, sir, and I hope you have a great day.
I will. Thank you so much for the time, Patrick.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.